sure you have over the years. Is there anything that
at this stage that strikes you as being a little unusual?
The
negotiations.
Abraham was today saved to get a burial place.
Okay.
So it was the life star was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years.
These are the years of the life star.
So it's taking it frozen 27 years.
Rashi comments on why they express it this way instead of saying 127 years.
I'm not going to get into that right now.
And Sonny died in Kiryat Arba, Hebron, which is in the land of Canaan.
And Abraham came, lived by the Torah, and was perfect. And he would die for her and to
cry for her. So there's a school point on that.
What is the difference between
Lispa and Teste? That's where we get the custom to eulogize when somebody dies.
And you see from here, actually,
the two aspects of mourning, of Avelis,
it really consists of two things, Hester and Mashi.
That is to say, eulogy and crying. But eulogy comes first.
What's the difference between the two?
What is eulogy and what is b'chi? What is crying? Renee? Good point. So what you're saying is that
there's two kinds of mourning.
There's subjective and objective. That is to say, b'chi is the subjective factor.
Person you attach to.
A personal relationship. It doesn't necessarily mean that this person
was special or was objectively
important to the world. Or anything like that. It's simply your own personal feelings.
So b'chi is the
emotional side, the personal feeling. But hesped is eulogy.
Eulogy means where you think about the objective qualities of the individual.
Now, really,
hesped is a higher level than b'chi.
Because you see, in you have both kinds of mourning.
You have two kinds of mourning.
For example, if one of the close relatives, one of the seven close relatives dies,
so the person has to is
obligated to mourn. That's a subjective. It doesn't matter whether that person was a
tzaddik, wasn't a tzaddik,
was a scholar or an ordinary person. As long as they're your relative,
I mean, except for certain categories that are
extreme, rishayim, so we can't mourn for them. But other than that,
it's a personal kind of thing.
But you also have a different kind of mourning. For example, if a gadol hador,
if
a extremely great scholar dies, so then everybody has to mourn
for him. In fact,
when Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away, so the fellows in the yeshiva did tria.
They ripped their garments because he was
considered to be a gadol hador, or a nasi, as they said. He was like the leading scholar of the generation. And even if you didn't know him personally, and you didn't have a personal relationship, you have to mourn because
it's an object phenomenon.
In other words, there's a recognition that there's been a tremendous loss
of Torah.
So that's hesped. Hesped is the recognition of the objective value of the individual. You have that also, for example, by Shira. And the whole concept of 3 weeks in Tisha B'Av. We're mourning for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And we're mourning for the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. Now that's not a personal thing. There's no personal relationship over there. We didn't know them, and nobody can claim that they feel anything in terms of a personal and it's a theory, an impossibility. But we should be on the level, and by the way,
as our Soloveitchik said,
that this is one of the hardest mitzvahs to fulfill is mourning for the destruction of the temple. Even though we do so, we go through the motion, so to speak, every year on Tisha B'Av, the fast of the ninth of Av. He said, it's a person to properly, and of course there are many things we do to mourn, to remember the destruction of the temple. Even at a wedding, we break the glass, and other customs that are done to commemorate the destruction of the temple. But Rabbi Soloveitchik said that it takes a person on an extremely high level to really mourn for the destruction, to do so properly.
Because
we're so preoccupied with our own needs and concerns, and even if we can get out of our own particular, we're concerned about other people, the problems of Israel, or the problems of Russian Jews, to whatever extent it's something that we can identify with. We're living in this particular time, it could happen to us, we're involved. But to be able to mourn for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash 2,000 years ago means that a person is on such an advanced state that for him, he sees the tragedy, he sees the loss of what it means not to have a temple. That takes a person on an extremely high level. If it's philosophical, yeah, if it's philosophical one, so then it doesn't have to be something which happened recently or immediately. In this case, I would say
it doesn't matter.
But it says by Yaakov, when Yosef, when they brought back the garment and it was covered with blood, and he came to the conclusion that Yosef was killed. He said that he would go down to his grave mourning. He'd never get over that loss. So everybody asked, but it's in the nature of a person to forget after time. In other words, after 12 months, the person gets over the mourning. The person's supposed to go on living. So what does Yaakov say? That he would go down to his grave mourning. In fact, the Rambam says that if a person mourns expensively, that's the way of the Gentiles, the way of idolatry. A person shouldn't mourn excessively. There should be a limit to mourning. So I want to say that the mourning of Yaakov for his son Yosef, because Yosef was his student, he taught him, he gave him over his most advanced ideas and learning. That's what Rashi brings that out in many places. So it wasn't just the mourning of the relationship of the father and the son, but it was mourning for the loss of the Torah. In other words, he was his best Talmud, his best student. And he recognized that his learning would suffer as a result of that. And that's something which is irreplaceable. All right, let's continue. Then it says, Abraham got up from his deceased, and he spoke to the people of faith, that was the tribe, the Chitim, and he said, I am a stranger and a sojourner amongst you. Give me a achuzas kever. How do you translate achuzas kever? That's a plot, but it the idea of achuzas means something permanent. It means a permanent place for a burial. In other words, he wasn't just asking for a place to bury Sarah, but he wanted a achuzas kever, a right, something which he would have on a permanent basis. Yeah. I know, but in the case of Abraham, it was different because that was his perfection. His emotional, his relationship with Sarah, there wasn't dichotomized. It wasn't that there was an emotional relationship, like a romantic kind of thing. And then, additional to that, he recognized the virtues. But his emotions were purely in line with the good. In other words, the emotional relationship was based upon his recognition of her virtues and her qualities. So that's why Hesed came first. And then the emotion went along with that. Anyways, this is very important. He was not just interested in a place to bury her, but he wanted an achuzas kever, a permanent burial plot. He wanted a permanent burial plot. And I'll bury my deceased from before me. So the people of Chais answered Abraham and they said to him, please listen. My master, you are a prince of God amongst us. In the choicest grave plot, you can bury your deceased. Not a man from us will withhold his burial plot from you to prevent you from burying your dead. So this is a very interesting kind of thing. What does it show you? They were quite impressed. Abraham had how did he achieve such a position? It's amazing that he had such a recognition. They called him Nasi Elohim, a prince of God, are you amongst us? And there's not a person that would even think of not giving you his burial plot. So how did this happen? How did Abraham achieve such a renown? This is very, very unusual in our history for a Jew to achieve such worldwide, such recognition outside of his own people. Even among his own people, but certainly amongst the strangers, fellow strangers in the land of Canaan, and before people who are especially advanced. And yet, listen to the way they speak about Abraham. So what was it about Abraham that achieved this type of a response? What did he say? How did he do it? How did they know that he was so terrific? Political figure. But I would say it's because of what he did. In other words, when God sent him to Canaan, what did he do? He traveled from place to place, and he would have large gatherings. Vayikra b'shem ha'rishon, he would teach people. But it wasn't just through his intellectual teaching. It was really the way in which he related to people, more so than any of the other avos. Each one of the patriarchs, the avos, represents a specific type of perfection. And the perfection that most associated, of course, they all partook of all the perfections, but the one that's most directly associated with Avram is what? Chesed, yeah. In other words, he was able to achieve what he achieved through the practice of Chesed. Chesed is compassion. Compassion, we can consider it kindness towards others. And you see from the incident with the three angels that came to visit him, the three messengers, he was sitting outside of his tent. So I would say that they regarded him as a prince of God, not so much because of his teaching. It's hard to judge to what extent they understood what he was talking about, or to what extent they accepted his teaching, but they saw from his practice. See, most people are impressed until they reach a high intellectual level. The average person is really impressed by conduct. That's why the way a Jew behaves is a matter of is a very serious thing, especially when the eyes of the world are upon him. When you read about incidents of Jews who are involved in scams or scandals and so forth, it's a desecration of God's name, Chil Hashem. On the other hand, when you read about a Jew doing something helpful, going out of his way for somebody, that's a Kiddush Hashem. And you see that Avraham succeeded. They regarded him as a prince of God. But that is the character trait that they most associate as being an expression of the divine part of man. That's the way, not saying necessarily that it's true or not true, but you might say that no, the intellectual, the ability to understand God intellectually or to relate to God in terms of one's love of God, that might be a greater expression of the divine image. But as far as mankind is concerned, that's not what impresses them. I don't want to use that as an example. But the point is, everything is looking very good for Avram. They're willing to give him anything that he wants. Then it says that Avram got up and he bowed down to the people of Chet. And he spoke to them and said, "If it is your desire to allow me to bury my dead from before me, please listen to me and let me make contact with Ephraim ben Sofar." In other words, he had his eye on something, the field of Ephraim ben Sofar. Ephraim. Now Ephraim comes into the picture. "And that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which is his, which is at the edge of his field, for a full price. Let him give it to me amongst you for a permanent burial place." Now, there's something that's very interesting in this. What's interesting in this passage over here? If you analyze it carefully.
Then sell it?
Yeah. He wants him to... See, they had offered to give. They were so taken with Avraham that they would give him anything that he wanted, especially at a time like that. Avraham was not content with that. Avraham wanted to pay money, and he wanted to pay a full price. But it's very interesting. Look at the expression that he uses. Because what he should have said was, "For a full price," instead of yitnenoli, what should he have said? Yimkerenoli, sell it to me. In other words, it's two choices. Either you're giving it to me as a gift, or you're selling it to me. Now, if I'm coming to ask something from you, and I'm offering to pay, some say, "For a full price, please sell it to me." I'm not going to say, "Please give it to me." Yet he chose to put himself in a disadvantage, so to speak. And he said that he's willing to pay a full price, but not only to give it, he asked them to please give it to him. So we'll try and answer that question. Alright. You're right. In other words, the Avram was acting extremely diplomatically over here. You can learn a little bit of diplomacy. I didn't mention it before, but look at his choice of terms are very, very precise. For example, he says, "Ger v'soshav anochi imachem." What does that mean? I am a stranger and a sojourner. I know there's many many midrashim on this. A stranger, I mean, that a Jew is both a stranger, he's part of the people, but he's also a part of the land. But what's the plain meaning of the text? Why is he telling that to them? So Rashi gives you the plain meaning of it. Rashi says, Ger me'er et acheret, I'm a stranger from a different land, v'nis yashavti imachan, and I've chosen to dwell amongst you. Now listen to this interesting medrash. The medrash learns this way. Then the medrash gives it a totally different meaning. That he was saying, in tirtu, if you desire, hareini ger, then I am a stranger. The imlav, in other words, if you want to be nice to me and give me what I want, so then I'm a ger, I'm a stranger, I'm not going to make any demands. The imlav, if you don't, eyetoshav, then I'll be like a sojourner, like one who, an inhabitant. The atleta min adin, and I'll take it by right. She'amali HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what God said to me, Lazarach etain es aret hazot. To your children will I give this land. You know what Rashi is saying? Rashi is saying he was communicating a subtle message. I am a stranger and an inhabitant. Which means to say like this. If you'll be decent with me, so I'm a stranger. And I'm asking you, and I'm as a stranger, I have to ask you, I'm willing to pay, and so forth. I'll go through the red tape. But if not, if you're going to be difficult with me, then I'm going to be a toshav, and I'll take it by right. It's my right, because God has promised me and said to your children will I give this land. Now what does that mean? Obviously this is not what he said to them. So the term ger v'toshav has two different levels of interpretation. And they're really a bit contradictory, because on the surface he's being extremely polite, he's being extremely diplomatic, but according to the Medrash, he's got a little threat over there. In other words, if you want to be nice to me, fine, but if not, I'll just take it by right. That's very strange. Because they didn't accept that promise. They weren't, if that was the case, if they knew about the promise and they respected it, he'd have no problem over here. So what kind of threat is that? That I'll take it by right. I think it means like this. Why did you, on the plain level of the discourse, why did he use the terminology of ger v'toshav? I think that was his understanding of diplomacy. There was a little psychology over there. What was the psychology? He was anticipating a certain emotion that they might have. What's the emotion? There's a certain resistance that people have against a stranger. Yes, somebody new. This is our place. He recognized, people, it's like a certain tribal feeling, a certain community feeling. There's always that, somebody new. Who's this new kid on the block? Who's this new person? A certain resentment. When somebody new enters the picture, people feel secure. They have their place, and it gives them a certain feeling of superiority. It's hard to sort of break in. So he was anticipating that. Like, here he is. He's just been around a little while. Now he wants a burial place, and so on and so forth. Like, who's this person? So therefore, he acted very humbly. He acted very humbly, brought it out into the open. He said, I'm not trying to assert myself. I understand. I understand that I'm a stranger. I'm not trying to be insensitive about your feelings. I'm a stranger. But nevertheless, I've come here and I've chosen to make this my place. And on that basis, I'm asking you to accept me. So he's being very diplomatic. Now, what does Rashi mean when Rashi is saying, Rashi is giving a contrary indication, that he was saying that, if I really want to, I can take it by right. See, it means to say like this, that really he was in a position of a disadvantage. He was at their mercy. He didn't have a card to play. Because he couldn't demand anything from them. He was at their mercy. So what? But as was pointed out, it wasn't really something that was on the market. Because it was just on the market that you wouldn't have a whole meeting. You have to have a big meeting, all the people in town getting together and making a whole to-do about this. If it's just something, you go into a real estate office and you buy some property, it's not a big deal. So obviously what he was asking for was not a marketable item. So he was at a disadvantage. Now when you're at a disadvantage, so you've got to be humble. So what Rashi is saying is that he was using that expression of ger. I recognize my place, and I'm not being pushy about it, and I'm at your mercy, and I'm asking you. I'm beseeching you. But when you, so that's very good, because that can evoke a certain sense in people. When you're not pushy, you have to know when to be pushy and when to be matzah pasha, one to be humble, one to be, you have to be aware, maybe sometimes you're in a position of strength, sometimes you're not. It's a very important thing to know in many situations in life. But even when a person is being humble and he's saying, look, I need you, I'm asking for a favor, I'm humbling myself. But at the same time, tosha, but you can't just grovel on the ground. That's not so good. What Rashi meant is that he indicated that I'm not completely at your mercy. You still have to be a person. You still have to be a godver, so to speak. And you still have to indicate a certain self-confidence. So there is a way of dealing with people when you are requesting something. You're saying that I need you, and I would like you to do something for me, and I recognize that it's a favor. At the same time, you shouldn't allow yourself to deplete your ego entirely, to be a nothing. That's not it, because people have no... People want... If you're evoking something, that people want to do something for you, they want to do something to someone that they regard as an individual, who has a certain amount of confidence in himself as a person. But when you make a complete nothing out of yourself, that's no good. That's what Rashi is saying. Ger v'tosha. I'm a ger, but I'm also a tosha. I'm also a person. Yeah. Let's go further. Now, what happens next? Then he says, so please get him in touch with Ephron ben Socha, and he asked for the Maris HaMachpelah. Then it says that Ephron was sitting amongst the people of faith. Alright, so Rashi says that he was elevated as a shofet on that day because of the honor of Avraham. And Ephron answered Avraham to the hearing of B'nai Faith. In other words, in front of everybody, so that everybody could hear him. For all that came to the through the gates of the city, saying, "No, my master, listen to me. The field I've already given to you." Very generous person. "And the cave that is in it to you I have given." Rashi says, I've given it. I regard it as though it's yours already. He doesn't want any money. "Before the eyes of my people I have given it to you. Bury your dead." So Ephron responds very positively. And Avraham acknowledges this. And Avraham bowed before the people, bowing as a sign of respect. "And he spoke to Ephron in the ears of the people, saying, but if you will please listen to me, I have given the money for the field, take it from me, that I may bury my dead there." So he's practically begging him to take the money. You see, the Torah is going on at length about this whole business about giving the money. It's extremely important. And Avraham was faced with a dilemma over here. And he had to use a certain type of psychology, because for whatever reason, Avraham did not want to accept it for free. Avraham was determined to pay money for it. But what could he do? He couldn't be, he was in a very difficult situation, because here they were being kind to him, and they wanted to give him as a gift. So how did he get out of it? How did he solve the problem? So take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, "Ach imato lu shimayinu." So what does Rashi say? "Ach imato lu shimayinu." Please, if you will only listen to me. So Rashi says, this is what he was saying. You say to me to listen to you and to take it for free. But for me, it's impossible to do that. Therefore, if you will please listen to me, halavai, would that you would listen to me. What's he saying? What's Rashi saying? What was he arguing over here? What was Avraham telling him? It reminds me, you ever have a situation where you have company and the company insists upon helping with the dishes and the host insists that no. You ever see a situation like that? And the host says, no, you're my guest, I don't want you to move, I want you to sit. And then the guest feels very bad, but no, I can't, I want to help you. You made such a nice meal, etc., etc., and I want to help you. And they keep arguing up and back. So I was once in a situation like that. It wasn't me that was doing it. I was observing this. So I heard the pasuk of the Shas, so who's right and who's wrong? In other words, should the host have the say, have the final say? No, I want you not to do it. Or is it the guest? Who's right over there? Who's wrong in this situation? Etiquette. What would be the
situation. Well, how would you decide this on the basis of it? I guess you could have your own opinion, but I said like this. I said that it should go by what the guest wants. Because according to what is your purpose? When the host is saying, well, to please your guest, your whole point is that I don't want you to do the dishes or to help because I want to please you. I want you to have a good time. So I'm trying to do what I feel is going to make you have a good time. But let's say that person is saying, but psychologically, I can't enjoy myself unless I do it. Right? So then according to your own premises, you should let me do it. Because you want me to have a good time, and the only way I can have a good time is by doing it. So therefore, if that's the case, then the guest is really correct. This is what Avraham is saying. See, the only way that Avraham recognized that Ephraim wanted to do an act of kindness. That Ephraim wanted to do an act of kindness. Now, if he pays for it, so then it's no longer an act of kindness. He's getting money for it. He's taking away his mitzvah. He recognized that Ephraim had that emotion. So he had to, but Avraham nevertheless wanted to pay money for it. So he had to do it in a way in which he would still enable Ephraim to get that satisfaction that he had done a favor for Avraham. That's why he said, you're doing me a favor if you let me pay. I'm not paying you because I think that you need, because I think you need the money. And by paying you, I'm not going to change the character of the transaction. Because I recognize that this thing is a priceless thing. It doesn't have a price tag. And that's why exactly when he says, for a full price, yet nenuli, please give it to me. Because it's not, you wouldn't say that. If something is for sale, if something's on the market, so it's a sale. But no, I recognize that this is not a sale, this is a gift. The only thing is that I'm going to give you a certain amount of money because I don't want you to suffer any loss, but I don't believe that by giving you that money, I'm actually buying it from you. That it's actually, in other words, it's not the money which is prompting you to do it. You're doing it out of the kindness of your heart. The only thing is that I can't accept something for nothing. So if you will let me pay, you'll be doing me a favor and I'll be able to enjoy the kindness that you're trying to do for me. That's the way he put it. That's the way that he framed it. Because he couldn't insult him. Then Ephron answered him and said to him, my master, listen to me. A land which is worth 400 shekels of kesef, between me and you, what is it? In other words, between two friends like us, it's nothing. And bury your dead.
Right.
He names the price.
Yeah.
He names the price.
Really
okay, so that's what Chazal say. Chazal say that we shouldn't be like Ephron. Ephron said much and did little. He said he was going to give it for free, and he wound up taking a hefty price. But this was considered to be a hefty price. And it says that Avraham listened to Ephron, and he doled out the money to Ephron, the money that he had spoken before the hearing of the people of Chay, 400 shekels of kesef, over lasocha. That means good currency, currency that can be exchanged, best currency. Like the yen, actually, so the not like the dollar. Okay. Now, what are the basic questions? What are the basic questions that we want to ask over here? Why did Avraham insist? I mean, we've touched upon it, but let's see if we can get into a firmer context. Why was it so important to him? What was the whole idea, first of all, of the Aaron Tanachela? Why is the Torah making such a big deal about this in the first place?
Especially if we don't believe in
He needed a place to bury. He needed a place to bury Sarah. That would not have been very difficult to acquire. Obviously, they all said to him, "There's plenty of burial places. No one is going to bury her wherever you want. It's no big deal." He wasn't satisfied, and he chose to make a whole big deal out of it. Then he had a special place in mind.
But he wants to be next to her.
Okay, he wants to be next to her, but it's not just him. You'll see that there are other people as well. But even that, Stacey, if, let's say he wanted a burial place for two. That wouldn't have been such an unusual thing. No, really. So, what is the big deal over here? We don't really make such a big deal about that. About where a person is buried. Although it is a mitzvah to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. There is a concept. And perhaps we'll try and explain that. What is the concept of being buried in Israel? I hope to try and answer that question, if I can. In fact, Lori is strengthening the question. The whole institution of shrines does not seem to be something which is important in Judaism as it is in other religions. In fact, when God buried Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, and it made the Torah makes the point of saying that no one ever knew or discovered his burial place. No one ever discovered his burial place. And then why? I mean, if anything, I mean, Moses reached the highest level of perfection of anybody. It says in the Torah, there'll never be another prophet like Moses. That's a good question. But over here, I just want to point out that we see that Abraham was involved not just in finding a burial place for Sarah, and for himself as well. He says, because if he just wanted a place, so he could have gotten a place where there was room for him and her. But what he had in mind was an achuzat keder, a permanent burial place. Now this permanent burial place was designed for some specific individual. Who was it designed for? Yes? Ah, that's also an interesting. It's brought down by Chazal. That's why it's called Kiryat Arba. This is a very special kind of a place. Well, primarily, according to the plain text, that's a medrash. That's not brought down openly in the story. But primarily, it was the burial place of the Avos and Imos, the fathers and the mothers of the Jewish nation. Abraham and Isaac, right? Yitzhak and Abraham and Isaac. Abraham and Sarah. Yitzhak and Rivka. That's Isaac and Rivka. And Yaakov and Leah. And interesting enough, Rachel never made it into it. Why not? We're going to show you that really she did. I'll try and prove to you that Rachel, in a sense, did partake of the concept of Yom Ha'aretz HaMachpelah. We understand what the concept is. But, and also, Chazal, the rabbis point out that that's also the burial place in Adam and Eve.
Oh, right.
That's why it's called Kiryat Arba. It's not explicitly stated, but it is brought down by the oral tradition. Kiryat, the wall of the four. Who are the four? Now, one of the pshatim is the four couples, the four zugos. As you mentioned, Adam and Chava. So, therefore, what Abraham had in mind was something very, very special. And that's why the Torah goes into great length, telling us about the acquisition. Now, even after he acquires it, let's go further a few psukim. Now, the Torah doesn't go into historical detail. Right? And yet over here it goes into all the particulars. Then what happens in verse 17? And the field of Ephron emerged, stood, Bayakam, it stood. That is in the Machpelah. That is before Mamre. The field and the cave that's in it and all the trees that are in the field in the entire boundary around it. For Avram, Lamitna, for an acquisition. Mitna, Kenyan, an acquisition. In the eyes of Bnei Ches, for all that came through the gates of the city. So why does the Pasuk have to put such emphasis upon this? Then he buried her. Only then did he bury her. So in other words, he did not bury her immediate upon the purchase. He purchased it, and then what happened? Then he waited, then Bayakam. Then it emerged, and it attained a new status. It attained, right, it became well known that this was the Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, this was the burial place. Then he buried her. Yachad him cover Avram Asar Ishto. In the cave of the Steh HaMachpelah, right? Alpinei, Mamre, Hechevron, keeps describing it there in the land of Canaan. Then in verse 20 again, it's not satisfied yet. Then by Yochama saw it. The field emerged. Bamara Shebo in the cave. La Avraham for Abraham. La Chuzat Keter for a permanent burial place. So what is the importance of this? What's the whole idea? What is the concept of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah? Now, why is this so? Why Avraham obviously was involved in something more than just burying Sarah. He was involved in establishing a new entity which was known as the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. And we see the importance of this. I'm just going to quickly go through some more sources over here, and then we'll try and explain what the kind of very, very significant concept over here. Let me just go through my sources. Chapter 25. Verse 8. It says that Abraham died in a good old age, and he was gathered unto his nation, and his sons Yitzhak and Ishmael buried him where? To the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, in the field of Ephron ben Socher Achiti, which was on the face of Mamre. Now in verse 10, the field that Abraham had acquired from Bnei Ches, there Kubar Avram Vasarishto. Was Abraham and his wife Sarah buried? Alright, so now mentioned it by Avram. This is 49:29. This is before the death of Jacob. And it says that he commanded them and said to them, I'm about to be gathered unto my nation. Bury me with my father to the cave that's in the field of Ephron Achiti, in the cave that is in the field of the Machpelah that's on the face of Mamre, and he describes it specifically in the land of Canaan. Asher Kana Avram, that Abraham had acquired, the field which Abraham had acquired from Ephron Achiti for a permanent burial place. You see how he keeps emphasizing it, re-emphasizing it, like we don't know which field he's referring to. And of course, as you know, at the beginning of Vayechi, he makes him take a shvuah. He makes him take an oath. That's at the very beginning of the Vayechi in Memchet in Lamed. That's 48:30, and I will lie with my fathers. First, he makes him take an oath. I almost said, please do with me a chesed, a kindness of truth. Do not bury me in Egypt. And when I lie with my fathers, then you shall carry me from Egypt, and I can bury me in their burial place. And he made him swear to it. All right, then we have the verse that I just mentioned. And now, as far as Rachel is concerned, Rachel, Mother Rachel, was not buried in the Aras HaMachpelah. And Yaakov apologizes to his sons for that. That's in 48:7. Chapter 48, verse 7. And he says, and I, when I came from Paddan, so Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was just a small little distance left to Ephras. And I buried her there on the road of Ephras, which is Beis Lechem. So she was buried in Beis Lechem, and not even in Beis Lechem, outside of Beis Lechem. So Rashi says, and I buried her there. I didn't even bring her to Beis Lechem to bring her into the land. And I know that you have some resentment in your heart against me for this. But you should know, he tells his son, that I did this because of the word of God. In other words, he had a prophecy from God. I buried her there, that she should be a help to her children when they were exiled by Nebuzaradan, Babylon. And they were traveling on the road. So then, of course you can't take this literally, but there's a concept over here. Then Rachel would come forth from her grave and cry and plead for mercy for them. As it says, Kol Baram Anishma. This is the Haftarah that we read, by the way, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. A voice in Ramah is heard, Rachel Mavaka Al Banera. It is Rachel crying for her children. So, and God answers her, Yesh Shkar L'Pol L'Sacha. There'll be a reward for your efforts. V'shavu Barim L'Gulam, and the children will return to their boundary. So he's explaining over here why he didn't bury her in the Maris HaMachpelah. But I think that there's a concept over here. If you'll understand this Rashi, you'll understand what the concept of the Maris HaMachpelah is. One second. You also see another mention of the Maris HaMachpelah. This idea is not to be taken, I don't believe this idea is to be taken literally. That it's a hard idea to understand anyways. I don't intend to go into that. That the deceased pray for the children. I know we always use that expression that the person should be a male tzioshar. But that's not something that I think one should take literally. There's an idea over there. But it's a very hard idea to take literally. That the deceased pray for the children. Alright. But where else is the Maris HaMachpelah referred to further on in the Torah? Anybody familiar? A bucky. Any bikini? Anybody a bucky over here? But it says that when they spied out the land, so it says they went up to the Negev, Vayevo at Chevron. They came to Chevron. And Rashi points out, Kolev alone went there, and he stretched himself out on the Kivrei Avos, on the graves of the patriarchs, that he shouldn't be deceived, he shouldn't be seduced by the idea of his friends, of the Mirago, to go along with their ideas. And thus it says that God promised he would give him the land. So the land of Chevron, when the Jews entered the land, was given to Kolev and his descendants. So you see that that Kolev, when he was in a situation of trouble, he went to the grave of the Avos to pray there. So, what is the concept then of the Maaros HaMakpelah? Why was it so important? You see that this is what Avraham was involved in. When Avraham came before the people of Chais, so he wasn't just looking for a spot to bury his wife. That would not have been a problem. The Torah would not have devoted so much attention. But he was involved in establishing something. And there is an entity of the Maaros HaMakpelah. And that is a very, very important concept. You see that that Yaakov makes an important reference to it, and later on they came to pray by it. So why was it so important? Why is it so important that the fathers and the mothers were buried in one particular place? And also it just so happens that Adam and Chava were buried there too. What's the connecting link? I mean, what's the idea? And what's the concept behind it? The practical idea is that it defines the nature of Eretz Yisrael. Through the nature of the land, Eretz Yisrael has Kedusha. What is the Kedusha of this land? You see, for example, that we read on Yom Kippur, when we read about the forbidden sexual relations and the abominations, all the perverted practices that the various nations that lived there were engaged in. So God said that we should not do these things, and the land will not suck your heart, the land will not spit us out. Which means to say that there is a special covenant with this land, that any nation which defiles this land will be thrown out of the land, even the Jews. It doesn't make any difference. And that is why the nations that lived there before the Jews, the Canaan, the seven nations, deserve to be destroyed. God did not destroy them and remove them just because to make room for the Jews. It was because their own corruption had reached a point where independently they were worthy of being destroyed. But God gives the Jews the very same warning, that if you defile the land, the same thing will happen to you, which is not the case with any other land. There is something special and unique about this land. Why? Because this land is designated for a purpose. It is land which was designated for the proper realization of the true idea of God and man's relationship to God, which is signified by what? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's why we say in our prayers. In other words, the concept, see, we can't have a direct concept of God. God is unknowable. The God that we relate to is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who related to God in a way which was completely different from the rest of the world. The rest of the world related to God through the method of idolatry. It was an idolatrous relationship. They discovered the true concept that man can have of God, and the true way that man is to relate to God. That's what we say in our tefillos, and that's when Moshe spoke to God by the burning bush, and he said, they'll ask you, what is your name? Say to them, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, Zeshmi La'olam, that's my name forever, Zichru L'Dor. God only associated his name with three people, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they represent the true concept of God. And that is why the Jews in taking over the land, and Moshe warns them in Devarim that when you take over the land, do not ever allow yourself to feel that you're special, that it's because of your greatness or because of your worthiness. Lo b'tzikasa, there's many, many psukim. It's only because of the shvua that I made to the Avos. So this land comes to you because you are the descendants of the Avos. And therefore it's important, and that's why Avraham traveled through the land, and that's why Yitzhak wasn't permitted to leave the land, and Yaakov to establish that toho within the land to indicate forever that this land is special, that this land has been designated for a purpose to realize the concept of God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's why if you live a corrupt life in that land, you're defiling. You're breaking that designation. So it's worse to lead a sinful, corrupt life in Eretz Yisrael than outside Eretz Yisrael. In terms of your own personal self, because, you know, you're corrupted, but in Eretz Yisrael you're doing something worse. You're destroying the entity. You're destroying the land of Israel itself. And there's many statements. That's what David said when David had to leave, to flee for his life. He said, the ultimate defection and the ultimate sense that a person is living his life constantly in the presence of God is only in a society. You can't do it in isolation. But the person is affected by his environment. So no matter how perfected you can be, of course, in this society you have to separate yourself mentally and spiritually, but to a certain extent you're always going to be affected by the values of the society. So the ultimate perfection can only be in an environment, in a society whose whole designation is for the purpose of realizing the ideas of God of all of this thing out there. There's one further thing over here. Yeah. There's one further thing. Well, that's the grave. Now, the grave indicates that this is the beginning. That's a permanent. In other words, that this is the land of the Elohim. It defines the nature of the land. It's the land of the Elohim. And we get this land only because we are the descendants of the Elohim. We're the children of the Elohim. In that sense, we're the children of the Elohim. But this doesn't explain the idea of kinyan. This does not explain the idea that he taught them a new idea, that the burial place, it has to be the field that I acquired. It's not easy to translate this idea of kinyan. Kinyan means an acquisition. But the Gemara in Kiddushin, interestingly enough,
in a sale.
The Gemara in Kiddushin learns out that one can marry a woman with money. Well, the ring is only because of monetary value. We use a ring because it's an object of monetary value. You could use money. You don't have a ring, so you could use money. And so the Gemara says that a woman is acquired, one of the ways that she is acquired in marriage is with money. Kesef. And the Gemara says, how do we know with money? So it says, we learn out a comparison. The Torah uses the same word. When the Torah uses the same word, you can learn out laws from both, called the Zereshava. The word is kicha. Kicha is taking. Kicha is the Ephron. Now, the field of Ephron, that's the field that we're talking about. It says by marriage, ki yikach yeshisha, if a man takes a woman, that's the word kicha, take. And it says by Ephron, Nasati kesef asad. I have given the money of the field. Kach me meni, take it from me. So the word kicha is used in both places, and we see that kicha, taking, is considered to be a kinyan, an acquisition. As it says, the field ashakana Avram, that Avram acquired. So, what do you see from this? That the field, the Maaros HaMachpelah, had to be acquired as a kinyan, as a possession. Now, a kinyan means something which is positive. Just like the kinyan is compared to the kinyan of marriage. In other words, if it's an acquisition which creates a whole new relationship, it creates something new comes into being as a result of this kinyan. So too, in the case of the burial place, something new comes into being over here. Now let me explain this idea. This idea was explained by Rabbi Chait last year in one of the Sunday Shiurim. He meant to say like this, that it's not what you think it is. That death, that burial is simply the removal of something. But death in Judaism is really a positive entity. And what is that? And that is that according to the philosophy of Judaism, it's expressed in Pirkei Avos, this world is a prozdor. It's like a corridor to the world to come. And that is to say that if a person has lived properly, he has perfected his soul, then
In other words, the existence of the person in a physical form is just one aspect of the entire existence. It's just a small part of his entire life. If a person lives properly, so then the soul is immortal. The soul survives him after the death of the body. So life on this world is just a limited aspect of one's existence. And therefore the idea that he was teaching them was the idea of the immortality of the soul. And that is what is the, that's the achuzas keder, that it's not just the removal of something, but it's the establishment. Kinyan means the establishment of something positive. And that is represented by, see, now you understand the connection between the Avos and Adam and Chava. Because Adam and Chava represents the fulfillment of God's plan. God created Adam and Chava in the most perfected state. That's Adam and Chava. But the rest of us, now Abraham, the fathers and mothers, are the instruments. They established that the world became corrupt. And Abraham came along and he rediscovered the true ideas. And they are the instruments for establishing the true system of ideas, which is to bring us to that level of perfection. That's what we say, that a person who keeps the Torah, Ashrecha Ba'olam Hazeh, that it's the best way to live in this world, the Tov Lach Le'olam Haba. And the ultimate reward is the life of the world to come. In other words, the person is focused purely on his existence in this world. That's all he sees, is the physical existence of this world, that he can never have a picture of the totality of human existence. Because as far as the Torah is concerned, this is just but one aspect of the life of the individual. In physical form, in this world, God has placed us in physical form for the purpose of achieving perfection, for the purpose of achieving the perfection of the soul. And if the person has followed the life of the Torah, so he enjoys the best life in this world, but he has to take into consideration, see, in other words, if a person is just looking at life in terms of the situation in this world, then he'll have a distorted picture. Because there's more to it than just that. He has to consider the ultimate. And ultimately, if a person follows the life of Torah, now I don't mean to say it's not like the Christians have the notion, false notion. They have the notion that a person suffers is like an investment. You suffer in this world and God rewards you with eternal life. That's not the idea of the others. The idea of the others is that the Torah is not a life of suffering. Durachah darchei noam, our ways are ways of pleasantness. Of course, when a person first encounters the Torah, many of the things seem strange to him. They go against his natural sense of how things should be. And once he begins to study and he understands, but we see that this is really in line with his true nature, and this is really the way of happiness. But it is not just the best way to live in this world, but it's the way to perfect the soul. And that ultimately the perfected soul, which is not physical, which is, so to speak, implanted by God, partakes of the divine, is eternal. So the concept that he was teaching them was the eternity of the soul. And that's the idea of the, that's why it's just Abraham, it's just the fathers and the mothers, and Adam and Chava. Because Adam and Chava represent the most perfected individual, because God designed them. They were created directly by God, so they represent the ultimate. And the fathers and mothers of the nation represent the means by which we are to achieve that ultimate state of Adam and Chava. Now you understand the concept. That's why when Kalish separated, he prayed by the, he went to the Kivrei Avos, because the Kiva represents the idea that their souls are still alive, that they never died, that in truth they never died. Death is just a different state in the odyssey of the person. It's the removal of the physical, and the soul still exists. So to commune, so to speak, to speak to the, to commune with the Tzaddikim, has a real sense, the souls are still in existence. Yeah, so that's why he went to the kever, because the kever reminds him of the perfections that they stood for. It's a real entity, and he was reminded of what the others stood for and the ideas that they represented, and this gave him the ability to withstand the false eitzah of the Meraglim. And that's the idea of Rachel. That's the idea of Rachel. That Rachel, exactly.
that when the children went, they were in exile and they were in a very lowly state, so they passed by the grave. It was important, in other words, because in the plan God knew that the Jews would exist in two situations. They'd exist within the land itself, settled, at peace, you know, in a permanent situation, but then there'd be a time of exile when they'd have to leave the land. So they needed someone, they needed one of the matriarchs to whom they could turn to in the moment of exile. See? And that would remind, so Rachel reminded them at the lowest moment after they had sinned and they were bound for exile and suffering and pain, that there's a way back. And the way back is through tshuva. And on the way out of the land, they encountered the burial place of Rachel. And this again reminds them of the true idea, that the model of perfection, and that when a person lives correctly and follows the way of the Torah, so of course they have perfection in this world and they live eternally. So Rachel, the idea that Rachel lives eternally was a vital thing for them to have on their way into exile. So that's why she too partakes of the concept of the Maaretz HaMachpelah, though physically she wasn't in the Maaretz HaMachpelah. The Maaretz HaMachpelah represents the idea that the person who lives in the Torah of the Torah has the best life in this world but lives eternally. And that was vital for the entire nation, and that's why Rachel also partakes of the Maaretz HaMachpelah. Right. See, that's why it says afterwards, after he purchased it, it mentions that it keeps mentioning it. Asada Hashem Bayokam Asada, and the field emerged. What does it mean emerge? A new concept, a new idea emerged. That Avram taught them a new idea, and that this burial place, normally a burial place, is not associated as being a place of anything positive. It's negative. It's the removal of something. You're just discarding something. But no. In Judaism, it's not discarding something, but it's the establishment of something. Something new. What? The perfected soul, which exists eternally. Of course, it doesn't exist physically in that place, obviously. I'm just saying it represents that idea. But that idea is a positive entity. And that explains why the Torah goes to such length into this whole story about the purchase. Other than that, it seems to be something trivial. It's not that important. Who cares how he purchased a burial plot? It doesn't seem to be something that's very important. But it is important because it's teaching a vital idea of Yahadah, the immortality of the soul. Because if you take a look at the Rambam in Perek Chet of Olos Tshuva, so he says, that's what he says, that the ultimate reward of the righteous follow the Torah is the life of the world to come. And he says we really can't grasp it emotionally, we can't relate to it emotionally, but we know that it's the ultimate good. Yeah. And according to this, why was it so important? Why is that the stress that he used, that universal? Well, on a practical level, it's in what I'm saying. Now, in other words, he paid Abba, the pasuk makes a point, nothing, everything the Torah said has importance. Abba Meir Shekel Ketzer, over Lasoka. It was 400 shekels of silver, which was universal currency, the best possible money. So Anna's asking, so why is that important? All we have to know is that he bought it. Who cares? The Indian, yeah. Okay. No, but it fits in with my concept. Because, I'll tell you why it fits in with the concept. It fits in very beautifully. I didn't think of this connection before. But you see, just like when something is a treasure, when you're acquiring something that you treasure very much, that would be demeaning to use something which is of low value. Alright, so when you marry someone, so you want to marry with something beautiful. Alright, so I know that halachically speaking, that's supposed to use anything with diamonds or stones. That's a halachic problem. But other than that, everybody, there's a certain value attached to the wedding ring, because it indicates how valuable the acquisition, you see? So Avram, it wasn't just for practical purposes, so that they couldn't say, to renege on the deal and say he cheated them. I don't think that's true. That is true, but that's secondary. He wanted to demonstrate by doing this, by paying that best possible currency, he was demonstrating the supreme value of that which he has acquired, of that which is represented. That this is the most cherished thing, the perfection of the soul is the most cherished thing.
In other words,
death is not the end. Not at all. This is a very important lesson. When a person plans out, most people, when they live their lives, they're thinking purely in terms of this world, as though this is the only situation. And a person, it's absurd, if a person is going to look at it that way, he's going to miscalculate. He cannot make proper decisions. He must, a decision that a person makes for his life has to take into consideration the entire picture. Anything you're doing, if you're moving into a house or into a neighborhood or a business or whatever you're doing, I mean, if you view it as only, you know, just going to be there for a year or for 2 years or whatever it is, or you're going to be there for that, I mean, that's going to determine how you act and how you invest your resources and what kind of decisions you make. Now, the same is true. The idea that the only existence is the physical existence, that's paganism. And if a person lives his life that way, that the only thing that he has is physical existence in this form, in this world, so then it's impossible for him to make correct decisions and believe his life properly. Why? Because you have to have all the information. If you knew that you just had, all you have in front of you is, say, 60 years, whatever the case may be, and that's it, life on this earth, physical existence, then just like an animal, like a dog or a cat, then it's over. That's one situation that you have to confront. Now you will make certain decisions in a certain way. On the other hand, if I tell you that you possess the divine element, and that if you live in a certain way, not only would you have those 50, 60 years of physical existence, but you will partake of eternal existence, the eternity of the soul, now that's a very important piece of information. Obviously, it's two different courses that you will chart. So that is the concept that he taught to mankind. That the greatness of the Torah system is that this is Chachmas Hashem, that it is the best possible life in this world. It's not like the Christians, you give up the trade, you're not giving up this world. Because one who understands the true nature of human happiness realizes that it's only possible through living the Torah life. But at the very same time, as a natural result, and not as a reward, in the sense that God is giving you something extra, but purely as a natural result, you attain the ultimate good, which is the eternity, the immortality of the soul. That was the doctrine that Avraham taught, and that's the concept of the Maris HaMachpelah. That's why it's the Avos, and that's why it's Avraham Chava.
Okay, and then?
Let's just answer
the
question.
No, he would represent that basically.
Yeah, with Moshe Rabbeinu, there was a problem. The answer we always gave, why was Moshe's burial place never revealed, is because there was a danger that he was
deified.
Could have been deified. He was the only individual that reached, because he spoke, they saw that he spoke to God, panim al panim, so to speak, that he left them and he went into the cloud and he was in such a high level. In fact, when Moshe left them, that's when they got the idea to build the ego.
Right.
They didn't have Moshe anymore. So therefore, there was a danger that they would worship it at the shrine, that they would deify Moshe. So the Avodah Zarah. So it would have been dangerous for the Jews ever to have the burial place. I don't want to get too much into what's going on in the world today, but this is not ancestor worship. I hope nobody associates it. That's a completely fallacious idea. Like you have the Japanese, they worship ancestors. That's not what this is about. And unfortunately, I think many people today in Israel that go to the graves, it's become a mystical kind of thing. It's not the idea to go to the graves of the Avos, and somehow, you know, you imagine that they're going to intercede for you and do things for you. I mean, that's a complete distortion. No, the benefit is that you perfect yourself because you relate to the ideas that they represent, and you become a better person. But if you have this notion that there's some kind of an ancestor worship and they can do things for you mystically and magically, then that's really a terrible thing, terrible distortion.